Welcome to Component 4, Introduction to Information and Computer Science. This unit is in five parts. This is Unit 7, Networks and Networking, Part 4. The objectives of this unit include gaining the ability to understand the history of networks and their evolution, list and describe the various types of network communications, list and describe the various forms of network addressing, including DNS. List and define the different types of networks. Describe different network topologies. List and describe different network standards and protocols. Describe wireless communication. List and describe network hardware. And explain logical network model concepts. Part 4 will focus on the 7th and 8th objectives. Gaining the ability to describe wireless communication, and list and describe network hardware. In Part 5, we will focus on logical networking model concepts. Wireless communication happens without cabling. Signals are sent via infrared light, for example, laptop to laptop, by microwave, which requires a clear line of sight between the sending and receiving devices, and by radio frequency, which is the most common method used today. All signals are governed by the IEEE 802.11 standard. Wireless communication is prevalent throughout the world, and its use is only going to continue to grow. Now, we will briefly discuss the good, the bad, and the ugly aspects of wireless communication. Wireless communication usage is ever increasing because cables are not needed to connect devices to a network. The benefits of this include a cleaner physical work environment, portability. For example, you can carry a laptop around campus and connect to the internet wherever you go. And it is easy for users to connect to the network if the network provides open connectivity. The bad part about wireless is that signal interference and other factors can cause slower connection speeds than wired networks. For example, a signal may not have the ability to fully penetrate walls, which weakens the signal. Additionally, the signal range is often limited. In fact, the farther a wireless device moves from its wireless access point, the lower the throughput. Once the device moves outside of the wireless access point's effective range, then no wireless communication can occur. In a typical home network, this is usually only about 50 feet, or approximately 15 meters. The ugly part about wireless communication pertains to security issues. All wireless devices have the ability to view all wireless network traffic using special software known as a sniffer. Network administrators must plan for this type of activity and obviate it. If you want users to be able to utilize wireless communication without concern about whether their passwords and usernames and even data itself are stolen, then you must be prepared against those who are going to try to sniff or intercept electronic communications. How does wireless communication happen? How does it function? Home wireless communication is accomplished by radio frequency. Radio frequencies map to specific wireless channel numbers. In North America, channels are 1 through 13 for the technologies that are governed by the 802.11 A, B, and G standards. The following equipment is necessary to set up wireless communication in your home. You need computers with wireless NICs, which facilitate the connection of the device to a wireless router or a wireless access point. The network needs a wireless router known as a WAP. The wireless router then connects to a wired device. For example, to obtain internet access, the wireless router needs a wired connection to an ISP device, such as a cable modem router. When you set up your wireless network, it is very important that you configure the wireless access point for secure communication. One of the things that you have to set is the SSID, Service Set Identifier, or the name for your wireless network. It is basically the same thing as the workgroup name in a wired network. You should change the WAP's default password, since the default password of any wireless router can be found on the internet. Next, you have to supply the WAP with an IP address and subnet mask, and then ensure that the IP address and subnet mask are in the range of the computer and other devices that will connect to the wireless network. You should configure WPA2, a wireless security protocol, and then record the code or phrase that was created for later use when you configure wireless clients. Next, you need to cable the wireless access point so that it connects to the ISP device. You also need to configure each wireless client. One configuration is to ensure that the wireless client has the same SSID configured on the WAP. The wireless client also needs an IP address and subnet mask that is in the same IP address range as the WAP. It is important to point out that the WAP and client cannot have the same IP address, although they should have the same subnet mask. Ensure that all devices are configured with unique IP addresses and the same subnet mask. Finally, we configure WPA2 using the code or phrase that we recorded from when we configured the wireless access point. If you would like more details about wireless networks, examine the slide notes for this slide. You might pause the presentation, look at that detail, and then click play when you are ready to continue the presentation. It is important to keep in mind that standards are backwards compatible. In other words, 802.11g NICs work with 802.11a or b device-controlled wireless LANs. Wireless access points and clients must also use the same channel. We mentioned that valid channels are between 1 and 13 in North America. If a wireless access point is on channel 6 and a client is on channel 1, they will not be able to communicate with each other. Again, channel numbers correspond to an RF range. Note that channels 1, 6, and 11 frequencies do not overlap one another. Therefore, in North America, it is good practice to use one of these frequencies. For example, channel 5 uses the radio frequency range of 2.421 through 2.443 GHz. Notice that channel 6 uses the radio frequency range of 2.426 through 2.448, which slightly overlaps the range of channel 5. This overlap can interfere with wireless communication for devices using both frequencies. The image on this slide is of a laptop connected to a wireless access point via a PC card. The PC card connects to the laptop's PC card port. The wireless access point is on the table, and on the back of the wireless access point between the antenna, you see cables extending out. One of the cables is to provide power to the access point. The other cable is to connect the wireless access point to the wired network. This type of configuration is required if this laptop needs to be able to communicate with wired devices or to access the Internet. Typical network hardware includes network devices, a NIC, either wired or wireless, a switch, a router, an ISP device if we want Internet access, a server if we need to manage a domain, a surge protector, and an uninterruptible power supply, which is known as a UPS. Let's look at these in more detail. Network devices include computers, laptops, printers, and scanners that have a network-enabled operating system. For example, your computer might be running Windows 7, Windows Vista, or Windows XP. Each of these operating systems can provide the services required for network communication between applications installed on the computer and the network hardware. These devices need an installed NIC, which will allow them to connect to a switch or router, as well as cabling for a wired network. For a device to communicate on a network, it must have a NIC or network interface card. The hardware uses operating system services to communicate on the network. A service is a program that is part of the operating system and is always running. A wired NIC requires cabling and jacks, and ultimately a switch and a router for network access and communication. A wireless NIC requires a wireless access point and some wired device through which the wireless access point will communicate with other wired devices. The images on the screen illustrate a couple of NICs. The image on the bottom left of the slide is a vintage 10 megabit per second Ethernet NIC for wired network communication. This old-style NIC has two connector types on it. The connector type on the left side of the image is an old BNC connector type. The connector type on the right side of the image is what you would see currently, where you would plug in an RJ45 jack Ethernet cable. The image on the right side of the slide is of a 54 megabit per second wireless PCI card, which relates to the 802.11g standard. One of the most important pieces of hardware in a network is the switch. Wired devices plug into the switch via an Ethernet cable to communicate with each other. In other words, if your computer has a wired NIC installed, then you would plug a network cable's RJ45 jack into the NIC, and then plug the RJ45 jack on the other end of the cable into one of the ports shown on the switch. Then, any other device that is plugged into that switch will be able to communicate with your computer. The switch then plugs into an ISP device to provide internet access. The figure on the slide shows a 5-port switch. Switches only allow communication between hosts sharing the same IP address and subnet mask range. Switches forward traffic to devices in their network based on the MAC address of the devices. However, switches are programmed so that devices in different IP address ranges, different networks, are unable to communicate with each other unless a communication is permitted by a router through an access control list rule. Switches are not routers. However, some of the more expensive routers perform the actions of switches and routers. Switches that can perform router operations are called Layer 3 switches. A switch learns MAC addresses by reading traffic sent through all of its ports. Therefore, with a computer plugged into a switch port, when the computer communicates, the switch itself receives that information and reads the communication. Part of that communication includes the NIC's MAC address, IP address, and subnet mask assigned to the computer. If the switch receives traffic for a MAC address that it is familiar with, the switch sends that traffic to the switch port associated with that MAC address. If the switch receives traffic for an unknown MAC address, the switch forwards that traffic out of all of its other ports. That traffic will eventually make its way to a router, which will try to locate the destination network, and then route the traffic accordingly. Another important piece of hardware in a network is the router. A network boundary is defined by IP addresses and subnet mask numbers. A router can connect different IP address networks so they can communicate with each other. Routers such as ISP devices and wireless access points can be wired or wireless. The image on this slide is of a Cisco Linksys wireless router, typically found in a small office, home office, or SOHO network. The blue Ethernet cable extending from the back right of the router connects this wireless access point to the wired network. As mentioned previously, routers use IP addressing to route network traffic. Note that routers route and switches forward traffic. Routers have routing tables so that they know where to route received traffic. Switches do not have routing tables. They just keep track of MAC addresses by switch port and can send communication to its local area network, not to a remote network. Routers are usually configured with a default route, which is the IP address of another router. In other words, if the router has no idea where a destination device is located, it sends that traffic to its default router. If a router receives traffic for a destination not found in its routing table, the router sends that traffic to its default route. The hope is that the default router will know where to route this traffic. Ultimately, if the router does not have a destination route in its routing table and the router is not configured with a default route, the router drops that traffic. This means that the communication does not reach its destination. This might happen in a small office network, but it should never happen in a business network or on the internet. This image shows a small office network interconnected by an ISP router with switch ports. The ISP router connects the devices in the small home office to the internet. Assuming correct IP addressing, the three home devices can communicate with each other and the internet. An ISP device, for example, a cable modem router, connects either your home or your office network to the internet. You can lease these pieces of hardware from your ISP when you sign up for internet service. You can purchase them as well. The ISP device usually has one internet port, which you connect to a wall port. The ISP will usually provide you with the necessary cabling and other supplies needed to connect to the ISP device. This device usually has one switch port to connect one office or home device via an Ethernet cable. You can decide to use that port to connect to a switch, which can then connect to other devices or even other switches to extend your network. You do not need to purchase or lease a more expensive device from your ISP to connect your other devices to the network. In this case, all the devices share the one internet connection, which is fine. Now we will examine some ISP devices. The image on the left shows a Motorola cable modem router. This router uses the ISP's coaxial cable to provide internet connectivity. The image on the right is of a wireless D-Link router modem, typically used as a residential DSL gateway. This router uses the ISP's Ethernet cable to provide internet connectivity. Another network device is a server, which is a computer with a specialized operating system installed. Server examples are Windows Server 2008 or 2003, Ubuntu Server, and Novell's Open Enterprise Server. A server creates what we referred to as a gated community of devices and users. A server maintains a database of its objects, objects being devices and users. It restricts access to the network to only authorized devices and users, and manages all of these objects. In other words, a server determines which users can log on to the network, if at all. A server can also enforce rules that determine who can print to a specific printer. Servers can provide a number of functions, including taking on the role of domain controller, which is the guard of the gated community. A print server managing the printers that are part of the network. A DHCP, or domain host configuration protocol, which is the server that provides IP addresses and other configurations to devices. A DNS, or domain naming system server, so that device names can be translated into IP addresses. The file server, which might allow users to store their documents within specific folders on a hard drive of the server. A certificate server, which involves secure communications within a network and with other types of functionality. And a NAP, or Network Access Protection Server, which acts to protect the network from devices without virus protection software. These are just a few of the roles a server can fulfill in a domain. A device with a motherboard should be plugged into a surge protector, which is plugged into the wall. Surge protectors protect devices from spikes in power, usually originating with the power company. Some power strips are also surge protectors. Carefully read the product information to differentiate between the two. Devices need to be plugged into the surge protector to gain protection. If a power surge occurs and the device was not plugged into a surge protector, the motherboard circuitry might be destroyed. This means that if your microwave device, your computer, your iPod, your iPhone, and other devices are plugged directly into a wall outlet that experiences a surge in power, the motherboard on any of these devices can be destroyed. Make sure that you use a surge protector for all of your electronic devices, but especially for your computer, servers, printers, and portable devices. Protection through the use of a surge protector is measured in joules. Joules define how much electricity the surge protector can absorb without failure. You should consult an electrician if you need to understand the number of joules a surge protector should offer to protect your hardware. If you want to ensure that your device does not immediately shut down due to power loss, purchase and install an uninterruptible power supply, or a UPS, which provides emergency power to attached devices when power fails. A UPS provides short battery time, usually 5 to 30 minutes, depending on the devices that are attached to the UPS, and the battery power provided by the UPS. You can plug a computer and monitor directly into a UPS outlet. Then, if your home or your office experiences a power loss, you will be able to safely shut down your computer, rather than it abruptly shutting down due to a lack of power. If you have a whole building or campus that you need to protect against power loss, then you need a more robust solution. For example, you might have a UPS in a central location, with all electricity connected to the UPS. Call centers typically have this type of a setup. Note that you should never plug a laser printer into a UPS. A laser printer will instantly drain all of the available UPS battery power. This means that if you have your computer, your monitor, and a laser printer plugged into the UPS, and you lose power, all of those devices will immediately shut down, because the laser printer itself will drain all of the power in a matter of moments, rendering the UPS useless. Always plug a laser printer into a surge protector, and then plug the surge protector into a wall outlet. Then plug your computer monitor and other devices into the UPS, and then plug the UPS into another wall outlet. Finally, most UPS hardware devices also provide surge protection. It is important to read the documentation to understand specifically how each type of device protects your electronic equipment. The images on this slide are of surge protectors and UPS devices. The image on the top left shows a large data center scale UPS being installed by electricians. The size of this UPS device indicates that all devices within the building will retain power in the event of a power loss. The bottom center image shows a multi-outlet surge protector that you purchase from any hardware store. In this case, all of the devices plug into the surge protector, and then the surge protector plugs into the wall. Finally, the image on the top right shows a freestanding UPS. This unit has different types of connectors for input and output. Your computers, monitors, printers, and other devices plug into the UPS, which plugs into a wall outlet.